Okay, I'm going to get started. And hello, I don't think this works. I've been fiddling with it. It's on. Volume's up, but so I'll just switch it off. Yeah. You can? Go ahead. Those channel numbers are different, so
yeah,
I can.
Just want to make sure.
Okay, while he's trying to get it, it's probably a channel problem. We were talking about So we're talking about page replacement in demand page systems. In demand page systems, processes ask for memory that's not there because of page faults. Because initially when a process is loaded, most of its memory space has not been initialized. As it runs, it generates page addresses. The page addresses is translated via the page table. The page table has lots of entries marked invalid. Anytime you hit an invalid entry in a page table, you create a page fault which kicks in an interrupt handler which will copy this page from somewhere on the swap space into main memory. So that's just the page in mechanism. And the page in mechanism will add a new page to the free area. And if you don't purge pages, slowly the free area will go lower and lower until it's all consumed. Now, if you have a lot of memory, this may not happen. Processes terminate and the memory gets freed. But in most cases, at least we have to go with the assumption that, great, thank you. So we'll have to go with the assumption. No? Does it, hello?
Oh, it's on.
Oh. Oh, now it's too loud. Okay, that should be more or less okay. It makes noise. But that's normal. Sorry, let me see if I can. Okay, so as we page in, things will start getting full and we have to do some page out. So the high level view is that we mark a certain area. There's this diagrammatically, this is the full memory. As the page in happens, the full memory goes higher. We can do very lazy paging, that is, let it go all the way and fill up everything, and then when we have a page fault, we take something out and put something else back in. Or we can be proactive and say we have a high water mark. If it crosses that, So paging in is always by demand of the process. Paging out, the operating system's fine tuner has to decide when to page out. You can wait till your memory is full, and then you do a page out followed by a page in, or you always keep some space available. By if the fullness rises beyond the high water mark, you start paging stuff out and paging stuff in, and hopefully you will not go up much further. But if your paging mechanism is slow, you may hit all the way to the top. When you hit all the way to the top, your system performance slows down and all that happens. And then if you keep on paging out, when do you stop paging out? When the empty space goes, or full space goes down to the low water mark. But this is like fine-tuning. What is the algorithm? How do you decide to choose the victim? You choose pages to throw out one by one based on some criteria. And this criteria is determined by your page replacement algorithm or page replacement policy. So page replacement policy So in the page table, we can have timestamps based on which page was brought in when. Or we can maintain a queue of numbers, that is frame numbers which were brought in whichever order. So there's a variety of ways of implementing FIFO. FIFO is fair, FIFO sounds good, it's easy to implement, it can be done. Fine. What's wrong with FIFO? We always find fault with FIFO. To understand that you're throwing away old pages. Who says old pages are not good pages? There's no such thing. It's there, maybe it's there because it's heavily used. So we shouldn't be throwing out pages based on its age. There is this made-up story about it suffers from Belady's anomaly. That's kind of an example-based proof which says that, look, there are traces, I showed you one, where if you decrease the size of your memory, your performance either does not decrease or actually increases. Or, putting it in another way, if you add more memory, your performance goes down. That makes no sense. But it happens in FIFO. And that's because it's not a stack policy. So what is a stack policy? I will not get into the details of stack policies because it's really not that important. So let's say you run something and you have n pages, and at some point the pages that are in this n page set, if you rerun that same thing with n plus 1 pages, at any point the n page version should be a subset of the n plus 1 page version, which is logical. If you do FIFO, it doesn't happen. The n page is different from the n plus 1. Some pages are there, are common, some pages are missing. It's not a proper subset. It's different. How does that affect performance? I don't know. But that's kind of a little more logical way of saying that maybe FIFO has some weird properties that makes it not a stack policy, which leads to strange behavior like Belardi's anomaly. But the overarching thing is that the older pages are not necessarily the worst pages. So in this hunt for a good page replacement policy, turns out one can very easily craft one which is known as the OPT opt or optimal policy. This is the best. So the best policy that's possible for page replacement is definable. The best policy works as follows. So we have a set of pages in memory. We want to throw one out. So I've got this set of pages. Which one should I choose to throw away? Pick one that is not going to be used for the longest time in the future, or is never going to be used, one or the other. And that is provably your best page replacement policy. Two things. How do you do that? And why would it be the best? How do you know that the page is not going to be used? Simple answer is you do not. So if you had the full execution behavior forever, if you knew the future, you could do the page replacement based on this algorithm. We do not know the future, so we cannot implement this. But that doesn't mean this is junk. This means that the two reasons why the optimal can be used. One is to get a baseline of how many pages will a certain run of a set of processes ever need to bring in. You can run the thing, figure out the page patterns, and then simulate the optimal policy that will tell you that this is the minimum number of page faults that will happen. You cannot get better than this. So it's good for comparative studies, simulations, etc. The other thing is, if you come up with some kind of a policy, you can compare it to this fictitious policy and say it's only 10% worse than optimal. So you need a baseline for measurements, for metrics, for comparison, and this is the best policy to measure against. Now, so it cannot be done. Okay, but I'm just kind of claiming that this is the best policy. How can you justify that claim? Intuitively, it sounds right. So, an informal proof would be This is time and frequency juggling. The optimal policy says you should pick PI. Can I come up with a better policy than optimal? Well, let's say I can. And that policy will pick page PJ. And we know, because of the construction of optimal, that the page fault on PJ will happen earlier than page fault on PI. So whenever you don't follow the optimal policy, you will get a page fault earlier than what the optimal policy has. Now, if you're always getting a page fault earlier, either you'll get lucky and you'll have the same performance as optimal, or you'll be worse because the rate of page faults will rise. Hence, you cannot beat optimal. But optimal cannot be done. So now, to hunt for something that does not look at the future,
reverse.
That's flipped around in time. So reverse as in reversed in time, not reverse of optimal, is the worst policy. No. I'm saying, just if I reverse it in time, in optimal says look towards the future and find the page that has the longest not used period. Okay, flip it. Look towards the past and find the page that has not been used for the longest time. Same thing, mirror image. And this would be called, you know the answer, least recently used. Least recently used is a stack policy, because the set of pages that has not been used for 10 seconds will be a superset of the set of pages that has not been used in 9 seconds. So if you keep 10 seconds worth or 9 seconds worth or the number of pages, the lower number of pages will be a subset. And you're not doing this FIFO like thing. Is it good? Now, it is good on the intuitive feeling . So essentially you're trying to achieve the optimal policy, but since you don't have future information, you're using the past information as a metric. So if really the past predicted the future, then LRU would be somewhat similar to optimal. Does past predict the future? In case of computer process behavior, it does. Empirical studies. Working sets move. Things that have not been used probably will not get used or not get used for the longest time. Things in that working set, which is this elusive set of pages that a process is hitting on, keeps changing slowly. So kind of intuitively you say it looks like it will be a good policy. Then empirical studies say that LRU is indeed a good policy. So problem solved, we should use LRU. But there is a piece of bad news. LRU is not implementable. That sounds weird. Why can't you implement LRU? To answer the question, how would you implement LRU?
Add a page when it's used.
So timestamp a page when it's used.
And then when you delete it?
Yeah, but then if you timestamp every page when it's last used, you will find the page that hasn't been used for the longest period of time. So that seems like a pretty reasonable answer, that you timestamp every page on use. And that is the reason why you can't do it, that you have to timestamp every page when it's used. So usage of the page. Use a page is simply a memory reference. Like it happens every microsecond, nanosecond, something like that. The whole thing about the process of the CPU running is that every cycle is accessing a page. So on every CPU cycle, or several times a cycle, or every three cycles, depending upon how the CPU cycles are defined, it is going to hit a page. For every cycle, can you record the time at it did it? Yes, you can theoretically, but now you've got to take a value, read it off of the CPU counter or the clock, and store it somewhere in some data structure. That's going to take you 10, 15 more CPU cycles. So suddenly you will slow down your access rate to horrible. The overhead of recording the time of every memory access is horrendously slow. So is it every nanosecond, every microsecond? Here's the thing. It is every microsecond if you have a CPU that runs at 1 megahertz. We don't have CPUs that run at 1 megahertz. They run at 1 gigahertz or higher. So you've got a nanosecond to do this recording. That's out of the question. And that's why you can't do it. So people then talk about implementing what's called LRU approximations. LRU approximations are more practical algorithms or implementable algorithms that behave kinda sorta like LRU. True LRU would require you to timestamp every page access. Can we build something that does not timestamp every page access but somehow achieves something without too much overhead? Okay. So one way to think of an LRU approximation is before talking about the additional reference bits algorithm, let's talk about page table entries. A page table entry is an entry in the page table that contains a lot of information. Part of the information is the frame number. And the rest of the information has various bits. The valid bit being one of the bits that's there. Remember the valid bit. Every page table entry, the page table is a set of entries. In our simplest case, in pure paging, the page table entries was just a frame number used for translation. As we evolved the paging scheme, people started adding further bits into the page table which serve for various purposes. So when we talked about virtual memory, we said we should have a valid bit. That way, the page table hardware can decide that the frame number is not here, the page is not in memory, we've got to initiate a demand paging page fault. Similarly, there's a whole bunch of other bits. Not everything is useful at this point, but let's talk about a few other bits. There are three other bits called RW and X, which tells the page table mechanism whether you can read that page or write that page or execute that page. That means that you can turn off the read bit and make certain pages not readable. Read protect comes in useful. You can make certain pages write protect. Write protect is heavily used in every operating system to make the code part not writable. You don't want your code to change because somebody did an illegal write onto code memory. The code memory is part of your processor's memory. Memory is always writable. A bad pointer can overwrite code. And that causes bizarre behaviors later, which debuggers go crazy over. So one way of keeping sanity and one way of making sure that various kinds of attacks are not possible is to make sure that the code segment is not writable. And that's controlled by a write bit in the page table entry. There's also an execute bit in the page table entry. That means read and write will be allowed on that page, but a fetch instruction fetch will not be allowed. For the longest time, Intel didn't have an execute bit, but now it does. It is very effective in stopping buffer overflow attacks and payload downloads and executing arbitrary programs. There's a whole bunch of reasons why security reasons why operating systems should support the X bit, but it's not up to the operating system. The hardware has to support it. So no data execution. It's sometimes called no data execution bit. Similarly, there is modify bit. And there is reference bit. So read, write, execute bits are kind of static bits that are changed by the operating system. The modify and the reference bit are automatically updated at runtime by the paging hardware. If you ever write to a page, the modify bit will be turned to 1 on that write, when you do the write. Now that goes back to a huge additional overhead. That means every memory access, every nanosecond, somebody is checking the page table entry and flipping a bit if necessary. But it's still a lot cheaper than reading the clock and writing it to the page table. Hundreds of times cheaper. So yes, they allow this additional hardware that will turn the modify bit on if you did a write access. And similar to the modify bit, there's a reference bit. Whether you do a read access or a write access to a page, the reference bit will be on, will be set to on. So essentially you can say all pages will have the reference bit on because when it was brought in, it was referenced. What's the point of a reference bit? So that silly bit which is there is sometimes used by page replacement algorithms, which is the additional reference bit algorithm. Okay. So far, any questions on all these various bits in the page table entry? So we are going to focus on the reference bit. I heard somebody say something.
So the reference bit means, what does it mean if it has been referenced?
That this page in the past has been read or written or executed.
Oh, okay.
So it has been referenced. The CPU has generated an address that fell on this page. Since when? Since the start of time, maybe. Since the page was brought in. Since the page was brought in, then there is no way the reference bit will be zero. The page was brought in because it was referenced. And it's sitting there in memory. It's still referenced because it was referenced. So that sounds like a silly bit. But we're going to play games with it. Okay? What we do is, we're visually, the reference bits are in the page table, but I'm redrawing it saying the reference bits are attached to the frames of the memory. That's not true. That's our conceptualization. Think of every reference bit for every frame in memory, which is really somewhere else, to be adjacent to that frame in memory. And at some point in time, I don't know why, we set all the reference bits to zero. They're all one because these pages have been brought in and referenced. But we run a little piece of code that goes into the page table and zeros out all the reference bits. And then we sit back and relax for a certain period of time. Set a timer for a certain period of time, and then go and sweep all these reference bits into sets of integers. So let's say I have a 32-bit integer associated with each reference bit. And I'm going to sweep this. This is the MSB, and this is the LSB. And at this point, so by sweep, I mean I take that reference bit, put it in the MSB, in a shift operation. Whatever is in this integer, I move it this way, put the reference bit in the MSB, and put a zero in the reference bit. So I'm adding overhead every so many, I don't know, milliseconds, 100 milliseconds, time quanta expiry, I sweep all the reference bits. Takes time. But I'm going to pay that much time, or I'm going to increase the granularity of this sweep operation. After a sweep operation, or after several sweep operations, we will notice that the values in these integers are not all the same. Some of these integers have an integer value that is higher than the others. What does that mean? The higher the value, the more recently it has been used. That is, there's a 1 in the higher order bits. The lower, let's say a value is all zeros. That means since 32 sweeps, that page has not been referenced. That would be a least recently used. But if all pages are sort of referenced in the past, I'm building a history of page references. And these values and these values of these integers will tell me how recently has it been used. So if we take a look at this, this page was used here and here. This page was used in these two periods. But since these leading zeros, this period, the earliest use of the page is earlier than this page. So this is more least recently used. And that way I can build a table of least recently used pages and then follow the rules of the LRU algorithm. So this is a construction that kind of shows LRU can be implemented this way. But the caveat is this is not LRU. This is an LRU approximation. Why? Because you're not recording every use, the time of every use. You're recording touching a page at certain intervals of time. So if two pages have the same value, you don't know which one's the least recently used. You know they're both kind of similar. So it's an approximation, it's not the true one. But it's a close enough approximation, provided this, the quicker you do the sweeps, the better of an approximation it will be, and the higher will be the overhead. And if you want to sweep every microsecond, that's going to be terrible performance. So you want to have high granularity sweeping. So what if I do these sweeps very infrequently? Well, if I do it very infrequently, I might find that all of the reference bits are one now, so we just have these very high values in this register or in these integers. They're all the same, they're all ones. That doesn't serve my purpose. It'll degenerate to random choices. So I want the granularity small enough that there is a variation in the values of these. Smaller the granularity, the more accurate it is. The more accurate it is, your overhead rises sharply. So now it's a fine-tuning of this algorithm to trade off accuracy versus overhead. Does that make sense?
So the bottom binary code with more less recently used, right?
This is more, the top one is more recently used. This is less recently used. Because I'm interpreting this binary value as this is MSB. So which is why it's called the additional reference bits algorithm. There are no additional reference bits. I'm creating additional there's only one reference bit. I'm creating additional reference bits in software by deploying this sweeping algorithm to pull out values from the reference bits and storing it in history registers. Or they're not registers, they're just standard integers in the kernel space, but you can think of them as registers. Okay, any more questions? Yeah?
So then finding the smallest number that's going to be done by the kernel?
By the kernel, yes. not hardware. You have to go through this list and find the smallest. How big is this list? Depends on how big is your memory and how big is your page size. So page sizes have, I still forget, it used to be 1024 bytes, then it became 4K. Now I think Intel allows variable size pages and they allow 4 or 8 megabyte pages, which causes some wastage, but the page tables and these things are smaller. So there are less number of frames when you make the pages large. So it's all a matter of optimizing certain things, your target and your overhead. So trying to do LRU approximations are kind of like finding heuristic algorithms where you can do something semi-intelligent using some schemes which are not, what am I trying to say? Come up with some algorithm which has a flavor of LRU to so that you don't do FIFO. So second chance replacement is another one of these harebrained ideas, but it works reasonably. This is keep a circular list of pages in the order they were paged in. And so it'll have a head and a tail, but you have a current pointer into the circular list. It started being, this list was the queue of pages that came in. But now we'll modify a little bit so that I have a current pointer, which means I'll treat this as the head of the queue, this is the tail of the queue. I can move the pointer. So, make it a reverse list. So now, if it was FIFO, I would throw this guy out. If I need to throw some page out, this will be the victim. Okay? Let's say I'm adding at the tail and removing from the head. However, the second chance replacement says don't do that. Follow a FIFO scheme. Pick this guy as head. If this is the one you're going to replace, check its reference bit. Okay, let me redraw this. Here's where the second in the additional reference bit, I was using a time to sweep reference bits. Here, I'm looking at reference bits, but I'm not using this time of sweeping all the reference bits. This will be a lower overhead algorithm. What I'm doing is I have a list. Each of those list items have an R bit. I'm going to have the current pointer pointing somewhere. Let's say it's arbitrary. Now, when it's time to throw something out, I will pick on the victim, which is the one that's being pointed to by the current pointer. If that guy has a zero reference bit, that's it, straight, I'm done. I replace that page. That means it hasn't been used in some time. I don't know how long, but it hasn't been used for some time. That's my LRU approximation. However, if it's a one, that means it has been used in the past. I don't know how, but sometime in the past it was used. I'm going to give this guy a second chance. I'm going to flip the bit to zero and choose the next guy as the victim and apply the same algorithm. That way, I am going to be hunting for a page in that FIFO order, hunting for a page which has a zero in the orbit. And moment I find it, I replace that and my current pointer goes stuck there. And then next time, I'm going to go forward from that point. And if all the reference bits are one, I'm going to come all the way around and come to the header again, and that's where I'll find a reference bit zero. I'll waste my time. But, so this, in the degenerate case, where all pages are accessed heavily, it's going to become a FIFO algorithm. But as long as there is a little few pages that are not being accessed very much, it is going to be better than FIFO. And it's much lower overhead. You have to have the overhead of flipping reference bits that are done in hardware. But all the software checking and sweeping of reference bits is not here. It just does the slow movement of the pointer every time you want to get a new victim. Degenerate case, it's going to throw out, it's going to degenerate to FIFO. In the best case where everything is not being used, it's just still going to be FIFO, but in that case, FIFO and optimal is the same thing because pages are not getting used. You'll throw out all the pages whenever you need new ones. But we can kind of guarantee that heavily used pages will not get pushed out. Every time I get to it, by then, the reference bit will turn to 1, so we'll give it a second chance. Unless if everything is heavily used, then it becomes FIFO and we'll throw out something. Kind of an engineering solution to the how to implement LRU. Goal is to implement LRU. But this is not LRU, but it kind of has the flavor of LRU implemented using the simple algorithm, which is FIFO. And that's how page replacement is done. Now, several classes back when we were talking about doing the paging using TLBs, caches. Cache replacement is probably done more of an LRU fashion. I'm not very sure, but these things apply to cache replacement also. Same theory, cache replacement, optimal will work best, FIFO is not that good, LRU is better, can LRU be implemented? If not, everything has to be in hardware, choose a simple algorithm to do LRU. More or less the same problem, page replacement and cache replacement. But page replacement is done by the operating system, cache replacement is done by the motherboard. So we don't know anything about it. Okay, any questions? So as far as I know, I'm done with memory management. So to review the whole thing, we talked about physical memory and contiguous allocation. Contiguous allocation is a big headache. You can't do relocation. You have fragmented memory. You have to have everything in memory. You cannot have virtual memory. It is essentially a stunted scheme. So long back when people decided to move on to paging schemes by adding significantly more complex hardware and caches to make paging possible. So then we got to pure paging. Everything is still in memory, but allocation unit is pages. We don't have to allocate contiguously. We can put anything anywhere. We can move pages around. And all programs or processes have uniform addressing. They all start at memory location zero and go up to some high number. And they can grow and shrink, but the growing and shrinking doesn't seem to be very good. So we need a flipped scheme like the P0, P1 thing from VAX, or similar schemes are used in Intel, but they're more or less similar, so that you can have a stack growth and a heap growth, one in reverse, and you have page tables, and you have some notion of segmentation. Then I probably should have done the protected pages and all that. I didn't. I did it today. That there's read, write, execute privileges. There's reference bits. There's modify bits. But, let's add a valid bit. If I add a valid bit, I don't have to have everything in memory. Then it opens up the whole avenue of demand paging. But the moment you do demand paging, what if your memory is full? You have to throw things out, which is page replacement. And that's all the realm of the magic that goes on in every operating system dealing with memory management. As programmers, we do not see memory management. Malloc and free are not memory management. They're just sugar-coated, pre-allocated memory being reallocated. So memory management is completely hidden from programmers and users of operating systems. It's totally under the covers. But that's what goes on there. Questions? So the next topic is deadlocks. I'll start simple, but let me give you a big, long disclaimer about deadlocks. Deadlocks can happen if you a sloppy programmer using semaphores and you reverse the order of semaphores. But we're in an operating systems class. Deadlocks do not happen in operating systems. It's not a topic that's relevant to operating systems. However, long, long time ago, God knows who decided deadlocks have to be covered in an operating systems class. So that's why we're going to talk about deadlocks. Things will get a little theoretical. The deadlock modeling, deadlock detection, deadlock this and that is all reasonably theory-heavy, graph theory-heavy. It's not an operating systems topic. It's more appropriate in database systems where it's much more of a problem. But they leverage it off. This is a required course. If you go into databases, you will know what deadlocks are. So we're going to get into this thing called deadlocks. Simplest notion of a deadlock . Suppose I write two threads like this. we can say deadlocks may happen. Question is, if I run these two threads, will a deadlock happen? I'm assuming there are V's. I didn't write the V's. Will a deadlock happen? Probable. So we're hedging. May happen. Probable. Why are we saying probable and not it will? Yeah. I'm not sure what you said. Semaphore is set to 1. Okay, the assumption is x and y are set to 1, and there are vx, vy here. And the ordering of v doesn't matter, the ordering of p's matter. Will a deadlock happen? Is there a way this will execute without a deadlock? Yeah, we've done a lot of semaphore programming. This is basic. It will deadlock? No, it may deadlock. It will deadlock in some cases, it will not deadlock in some cases. If T1 executes PX and PY and is sitting here, there's no deadlock. Because this guy will get stuck here and eventually T1 will come out. A deadlock will happen only if PX and PY, these two operations happen kind of simultaneously. Or if PX happens first and before PY is fired, this PY happens. Or if this PY happens first and then this PX happens, those are deadlocks. Once you have this and this executed, that's it. You're cooked. You are guaranteed to get into a deadlock, and this deadlock will last forever. So this is a program that may or may not deadlock. Now, can we speculate on the chances of a deadlock happening? No. Depends upon your adversary, the scheduler, who you can never trust. So as a programmer, I'd say this is terrible, it's going to get into a deadlock. If you actually run it, most of the time it doesn't get into a deadlock. But we don't talk about it. We just say this is bad programming, it's deadlock prone. How prone, we don't know. Okay? So some hand-waving takeaway is that there are situations in which deadlock can, may, probably happen. These are not guaranteed deadlock situations. These are called deadlock prone. And it depends upon program structure. It also depends upon certain resource allocation structure. Resource allocation is an operating system's problem. But as we'll see in the next few minutes, operating systems resource allocation is not deadlock prone. Deadlocks are is a property of resource allocation, which is kind of the reason it's in an operating systems class, because we do resource allocation. But it depends on the programs or protocols of resource allocation. We can make operating systems deadlock-free very easily. I'll show you how. However, another takeaway is if a deadlock happens, it's forever. It's called a stable property. The reason this keeps getting brought up is there's a close cousin of deadlocks, sometimes called live locks or starvation. Starvation is also might happen, and if it happens, it may resolve itself. A starvation may go on forever like a deadlock, but it's not guaranteed to. It may just stop getting starved because, you know, dining philosophers, somebody puts down all the forks and the hungry person can eat. Whereas in a deadlock situation, once you get into a deadlock, you know, it's never going to get resolved. So deadlocks are deadlier than live locks or starvation. Okay? Then we say that in order to model deadlocks, we start with the system model. We say, let's think about resource allocation. I'll draw the parallel to operating systems in a minute. Resource allocation starts with the process wanting something. Then that process gets something and is able to use that resource. And then the process has to explicitly say, I do not need this anymore. Example, P on a semaphore of value 1. You acquired the resource atomically by switching the value to 0, P operation. After you've done with the P operation, which is the acquire, you've got that critical section. And then you're going to be in that critical section as long as you want to. Then you explicitly do a V operation releasing the semaphore. While you're using the resource will not be taken away from you. And that's needed in order to have deadlocks, which is why I showed this deadlock using a semaphore. This situation happens a lot in operating systems. A process acquires the CPU, and then uses the CPU, and then releases the CPU. But it doesn't release the CPU explicitly, it's just taken away because of preemption. That's the difference. If processes acquired CPUs and did not release them other than explicitly, we would have deadlock problems in CPU allocation strategies. Similarly for memory, processes demand page memory, but you can take it away anytime. It's preemptible. Which is why deadlocks don't happen in operating systems. If processes pin down memory, which is allowed in certain operating systems to privilege processes, you can say, do not demand page this out, in which case you can have deadlocks. But that's a rare situation. Similarly for disk, you write files. You write files and you kind of use it and then you delete it. That's more deadlock prone because you may fill up the disk. Well, if you fill out the disk, it gives you a disk overflow error. It does not block things until the disk will get magically freed. So there are techniques, simple techniques used by operating system to not use this system model. But systems that use this system model, locking, databases, are deadlock prone. Okay. So we have this relationship with resource allocation, but in a real operating system, resource allocation is done without deadlocks. But in the generalized model, you can have deadlocks. There are four necessary conditions for deadlock. I'm going to explain what necessary conditions mean. The four necessary conditions, which we'll go over in a minute, says that all four of these conditions have to be present in your system in order to get deadlocks. These are necessary. These are not sufficient. That means even if you have this, you may not have deadlocks, but you have a chance of deadlocks. Going back to my first example of PX, PY, PY, PX, that program has actually all these four necessary conditions. But we've already talked about that it may deadlock, it may not deadlock. So the existence of these four conditions are needed, but the existence of these four conditions don't guarantee deadlocks. It guarantees deadlock proneness. So what are these four conditions? It says mutual exclusion. Mutual exclusion, we know what it means, but in this context it means that a resource usage has to be mutually exclusive. When I'm using the resource, you shouldn't be using the resource. And in majority of the cases, that's true. If you have a single CPU, if one process is running on that CPU, another process cannot run on that CPU simultaneously. It can run later where this CPU is deallocated from process 1 and given to process 2. That's okay. But at each point in time, a resource is used exclusively. So that's what the mutual exclusion condition means. If it was possible for everybody to use the same resource all at the same time, there would be no deadlocks. Case in point, read-only files. You cannot have deadlocks. You can just throw in any number of processes reading from the file. It's a shared resource. There's no deadlock issue. It must follow the acquire use release model. That is, if somebody is using a resource, you don't preempt it. That's necessary that you have exclusive usage of a resource until you purposely release it. Now, this is the reason why operating systems don't have deadlock problems. We take great care in making sure everything is preemptible. Okay? So once you have preemption, you don't get deadlocks. So if you don't have preemption, then it becomes one of the necessary conditions becomes satisfied. Hold and wait is slightly more advanced. It says if you use one resource at a time, you will not have deadlocks. But if you hold and wait, you hold on to a resource and wait for another one, now you're getting into the danger zone. So that's why I remember way back when I used to say, do not block inside a critical section. Just do not block inside a critical section. That's a hold and wait situation. You should completely avoid that. You never know what strange things will happen. So hold and wait is a necessary condition for deadlock. Deadlock is a bad thing. This is a necessary condition for bad things to happen. So can we avoid this? Yes, we can avoid this in programming and in operating systems, but it is very difficult, if not impossible, to avoid this in database systems where you're doing record locking, because you may need access to a whole bunch of things locked and you don't know in which order you'll be doing it. So databases have a problem with deadlocks. Even if you have all this, your system may be deadlock free unless if you have circular weight. That was talked about with the dining philosophers, had a circular weight causing it to deadlock. If you broke the circular weight by making one philosopher eat the other way around, it won't deadlock. So circular weight is something we will talk about in more detail later. It's kind of intuitive right now that this hold and wait has to kind of form a circle before you get deadlocks. So what the next topics will be is we'll start with deadlock prevention. How do you make sure things are deadlock free? Then I'll talk about why deadlock prevention is not always possible. So there's a deadlock avoidance and deadlock detection and all that. But that's when we will get into a bit of graph theory on modeling deadlock. Okay, that's where the theoretical stuff will start.